It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Some clowns were never funny. Some villains you never forget.
He died years ago.
You're sure?
I was there.
Some heroes will never back down.
Go to work.
The Joker is back, and it's no laughing matter. He's got a new crew.
On the double.
A new game.
A lot has changed while your old Uncle Joker's been away. New Gotham, new rules, even a new Batman. I'm ready to give this old town a wetty again.
Now the world's newest Dark Knight needs answers.
What can you tell me about clowns?
Drop it, kid.
You'll have to stand alone.
You're out of your league. I know every trick the original Batman and Robin knew at their peak.
To face a vengeful menace from the past, whose day is about to dawn again.
Let's dance.
Beyond Return of the Joker, the first feature-length Batman Beyond movie. Now available exclusively on video cassette and DVD. This time, the Joker is wild.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. Excuse me, wait. I got to throw the tire screeching on that. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Yours? I'm Paul Spitero, and as always, I am here with my good buddy Sean Whalen.
It is a pleasure.
Who is kind of sure that he's not the Joker.
Hey.
Pleasure to have you here, my buddy, as always. Yeah, that is correct. And you could convert at any time. They could have the seed in you. And we are here with our buddies from the Movie Film Podcast, Brian and Zachy. How you doing, guys?
Good. Happy to be back, as always. Thanks for having us.
It's always our pleasure. I'm always happy that you guys don't say, "Well, why should we come back?" You know, I'm always afraid that someday that thought's going to get into your head. And you can say, "But wait a minute, what do we get out of this?" isn't that what you call it? It was from Empire Strikes Back. I'm not asking what it's in it for me, but what's in it for me? Wasn't that Empire Strikes Back? I'm mixing up my Harrison Ford movies somehow.
Now I'm really curious what that's from.
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
All right. Well, I figured if anything, you guys would know. I'll come up with it at some point. But you know, my old age is taking over. Hey, everybody. I just wanted to interrupt the program to let you know that a little while after we stopped recording, I had the light bulb moment when I remembered that the line in question was actually delivered by Kevin Costner in Field of Dreams. I guess his delivery reminded me of Harrison Ford, so that's why I had said that. But, you know, as is often the case, long after we'd finished discussing it, then I remember why I had that thought. Anyway, back to our regularly scheduled program. The way my theory is, you only have so much room in your brain for information, and every new thing you take in pushes something old out. So,
yep.
You know, that's probably one of the pieces of information that went out.
Anyway, it's risky, but you don't.
We're continuing on our journey. Yeah, and well, clearly, life skills go out first for me, because a lot of the minute trivia stays. So it's got to, you know, something's got to clear the way for it. But we're continuing on our journey through the Batman films, and as we explained last time, we took a little bit of a detour and went on to the animated films for a two-film stop. Last time around, we did Mask of the Phantasm, which a lot of people consider to be the best Batman film, animated or otherwise. And today we're going to look at Batman Beyond Return of the Joker, which I think is another one that is pretty much universally well thought of. I think the biggest issue about this one is it is probably a somewhat more mature theme to it and storyline that is probably not appropriate for young kids. And this came out in 2000. If my memory is correct, it was at a point when I had the Netflix membership that had nothing to do with streaming, and you could request DVDs be sent to your house, and you'd get them in the mail, watch them, and send them back. And I'm pretty sure I got this that way and watched it with my son, who was probably 5 or 6 years old when we watched it. So I did a really, really bad job of parenting, because as I sit here today, I'm thinking you should probably be at least 10 to 12 before you see this movie. Well, I think under that, it's probably not age appropriate.
If you watched it back in, you said 2000? It would have been the
somewhere around there, 2000, 2003, sometime between 2000 and 2003, I'd say.
Yeah, because the version that's out there now is the unedited version, but it took them a little while to release that. So you most likely you saw the edited OK for Kids version, which has now just been taken out of circulation.
Right. That is that I have understood that, and I have no recollection of seeing it at some point and saying, okay, these are the differences from when I had seen it last time. So I'm not sure which version I saw, but I do think that when I saw it, it predated the release of the unedited version.
Okay.
And again, I think I would, like I said, I would say probably around 2003 or so. Okay. But I remember I personally always enjoyed this one. Again, probably not appropriate for a five-year-old. But I definitely enjoyed this right from the start. And I've seen it obviously a few times over the years. So let's go around. Sean, how about you?
This one's bizarre. So I've got every DC animated release. I'm a Batman guy. Behind me, I've got Batman black and white statues. I'm a Batman geek. I mean, Batman was my foray into all this going back to the 66 series. I've owned this and the Batman Beyond TV series physically and digitally, because I have it on iTunes. So I've got Apple TVs and stuff like that, do all that. So to set the stage and say, I thought I saw this and I have never seen this. Oh. I don't know how this is possible. This is so like, this is up my alley. I see all of the, you know, Batman Ninja, all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's, you know, I'm a Batman. So it's very easy. You put Batman in front of it, I'm going to watch it. I don't know how this happened. This was actually my first viewing for this. Because of where the story goes, it's kind of like, oh yeah, I would have remembered if I saw this one before. I thought I did. So when I was excited to see this originally, when we said, oh, it'll be a fun one to revisit. I didn't revisit this. I saw it for the first time for this. So this is going to be a fun conversation.
How about you, Brian?
I have to say same. This was my first time watching this. I was realizing that this era, I looked it up immediately. I think it's the year 2000. And this was when I was in college. and I was kind of like distracted and like missing things on TV, and like I was still going to the movies and stuff, but there's a lot of things from this era that I just kind of missed. And I'm realizing that this was part of it. So I had not seen this before. I'm not even super familiar with Batman Beyond, even. Like, I, the concept, yes, but not the show itself. And so I was very excited to watch this because I, just from Zachy, he was just saying that this is, this was a good one, and it didn't disappoint.
How about you, Zach?
So I watched Batman Beyond from the jump, from the moment it premiered, and I bought this on DVD, you know, the moment it came out, which was I think summer of 2000. So going back to what we were saying before, like, I very distinctly remember the edited version. I loved that movie too, you know, because I wasn't fully aware of all the little all the snips that had been made. So when they put out the unedited release a few years later, I was already on board. And I think Batman Beyond is just a great series. I think it's a great concept. I think this movie is one of the best evocations of everything this particular corner of the Bat Universe is capable of doing. Amazing animation, the voice work is terrific. Just everything. It's just a great Batman movie.
I tend to agree with you. I do think this should have some sort of mature warning on it for exactly the reasons that we've talked about with the editing. Like, once you get to the point of the full unedited version, and you get to the Joker taking over,
Tim Drake.
What is he? He's Tim Drake's, yeah, once he fully takes over Tim Drake's body, I could see where that would be quite unnerving for a small child. So, you know, scenes in the flashback when he's dressed up as a small Joker and then, you know, brainwashed. I could see like a young kid being very, very upset by this, and, you know, it's the stuff that nightmares are made of. I thought in watching it this time, I was paying a little bit more attention to just the structure of it. And I thought it was pretty interesting the way it was set up. And I think it was set up so that people who were watching the series and familiar with the DC animated universe would enjoy it. But I think it also did a good job of presenting it in a way that somebody like, say, Brian, who had never seen or wasn't familiar with Batman Beyond, could watch this and follow along without really having too much difficulty. The structure of it, where they kind of give you a third of it in, you know, to set up the conflict. Then there's another third where you have the flashback showing what happened with the original Batman and the Joker. And then coming back to the, you know, in quotations, present, where now they're confronting the current iteration of the Joker with the current iteration of Batman. And I thought that was really well done, but also, you know, kind of out of the ordinary for the structure of a movie like this. Any thoughts, guys?
I completely agree. Yeah, I mean, I am familiar with the look, like, of the character and everything, but I didn't know the concept really, and I was never lost. I immediately understood, you know, that we were in like a future-ish day after tomorrow Gotham, you know, still though a time period where Bruce Wayne is still alive, and seeing him as sort of a grizzled mentor figure, and that McGinnis is a very different type of Batman. He like wisecracks, and, you know, I love that plays into the finale, even the way that he learns how to get under the Joker's skin. So yeah, it was very easy for me to understand and get into this.
I think it works
on the recent legacy. I'm sorry, go ahead, Sean.
I think it works on another layer too, for, you know, your comic geeks that are coming in, which I'm referencing me. You think there's certain characters that are canon, certain characters are not going to screw with, certain characters are not going to. And in this one, boy, what they do with Tim Drake in this one, I think is bold. I think it, you know, wound up being a surprise and left the story being very, very captivating, because there was always, I think, as a longtime comic reader, this sense of disbelief. Can't be Tim. They're not going to be doing this with Tim. And I loved that, especially with the fact that this is a universe that doesn't have a Jason Todd character in it. So I loved that there was this opportunity to do something really scary with the Joker in a way that felt fresh. And I think appeals to your point, Paul, to a lot of different audiences by the structure of the story. So that way everybody, it doesn't matter who you're with, you can all watch this and get something fresh and spectacular out of it. I mean, it really, there was some surprising choices in this. This is a very bold movie.
Right. I think if you didn't have a familiarity with it, you still don't feel like you were left behind. And that's really important. But then on the other hand, it's also important to not alienate the people who are familiar with it and feeling like, oh, now I got to sit here and rehash all this old stuff. And they never got bogged down in that, which is pivotal to make this a universally enjoyed movie. I think when it comes to legacy characters, at least the modern ones, I mean, we could go back to, you know, the early Showcase issues when they rebooted Green Lantern and Flash and all of that. That's another world as far as I'm concerned. And that, I'm thankful to say for one time that it's even before I was born. but of the modern ones, I think Batman Beyond and Miles Morales Spider-Man are by far the two most accessible and successful of the, of the rebooted legacy heroes. And I think that's borne out a little bit by this movie and then the Beyond the Spider-Verse movies that they came out with. That supposedly we were getting another one a year after the last one, and it's been 4 years, I think. But whatever, it's one day. This one, I was looking it over. I thought this had a stellar voice acting cast. I was a little impressed by some of the names that didn't necessarily even, headline it. But when you start reading them and you're like, oh, I know that person. The one who surprised me the most was the recently departed Terry Garr. I didn't expect to see her name along in the credits on this one. But, Mark Hamill, obviously, as the Joker, has become, I think, the definitive Joker voice. Pretty much everybody universally thinks of Kevin Conroy as their Batman, even without having ever seen him do it physically. So just on the voice alone, people put him above all the live-action Batman. So, it's a little disappointing to see how many people on this list are no longer with us. And one of the things I thought of, I think this is a byproduct of the pandemic. It used to be you'd hear that somebody died and you thought, oh, I thought he died 10 years ago, that kind of thing. Now I'm reading that somebody died in the last 5 years. And it's like, I had no idea that that person died. And I think it's a pandemic thing. There was the one who I saw in here that I didn't know died was Dean Stockwell, who died in 2021. But, I can't criticize any of the voice choices or casting in this. I think it was extremely strong and well done.
Yeah, I love sometimes when I watch these animated things, and I'm speaking very broadly, but there's different types of performances. There's the very like, well, we've got to head to the store, kind of animated, in character voice acting. And then there's like the really naturalistic where they're not pretending or trying to emote with their voice so much and just allowing the naturalism to come through. And I noticed that a lot with Angie Harmon as Barbara Gordon. Like I felt like I was listening to something that could have been a live action performance that was animated over. And personally, that always resonates better with me. So yeah, I agree. I really liked all the voice acting. It's Dean Stockwell, of course, Terry Garr. Yeah, when I saw her name pop up, I was like, no way.
It impresses me with this voice cast, considering how many of them are so identifiable. That really the people that stood out to me as being, I know who that is Kevin Conroy, Mark Hamill, Will Friedle, because we're used to them being in the Batman Beyond universe. And, Mark Hamill's history of the Joker and everything like that. But the rest of them, to their testament, I was right, Paul, when you were saying like Terry Garr and throwing her name out, there's somebody, Michael Rosenbaum, who's done like a ton. Henry Rollins being in this. None of them, I'm going to be honest, watching it through, I had to look afterwards to see who the voice cast was. And I'm only noting that because I just think that's great voice acting. When you're not like taken out of your suspense of disbelief by the fact that this talent is playing the characters. so that when you're watching an animated feature, you're just totally captivated by what's going on. And I think there's something about, you talk about maturity. I think maturity of acting talent, when it's not about yourself, it's about the product that you're putting out there. It's about the performance. And I think that's standing out in this one in a great way.
I think the biggest kick I got out of any voice acting in this, and it was done just enough. If it had been done more, it probably would have been overplayed. But I really got a kick out of Michael Rosenbaum doing his Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
As what was his name? Ghoul. You know, there was no question that's what he was doing. And what I had heard was on the cast of Smallville, he would often do that act, you know, that imitation for fun. And people got such a kick out of it that they specifically said, we want you to do that voice in this movie. And it was perfect to the character too. So I really got a big kick out of it.
It was one of those things when the first few lines came out of his mouth, I was like, am I hearing that right? That reminds me, that's very Walken-esque. And oh, he is doing Christopher Walken. Got it. And especially I can imagine in 2000, I feel like that was before everybody was doing a Walken. You know, I feel like there was a moment, and I don't know, maybe it came after the cowbell sketch where everyone had lines that they could repeat so easily in his voice, but it feels like he was on the at the beginning of something there, and it was very funny.
I thought the Walken imitation came in vogue when Pulp Fiction came out. Mm. That was the point where I felt like I started hearing it a lot more often from people, basically aping what he did in that movie, saying the, right. You know, those lines.
Yep, the watch speech.
Yes. I don't know if there's anybody else who really jumped out at me. I mean, interesting to see people like Frank Welker, you know, what's his name, from Scooby-Doo, Fred from Scooby-Doo on the cast, Lauren Tom.
Oh, Rachel Lee Cook. I was Terry surprised Garn. To see her name and then surprised that she was such a minor character.
And I have
that was
to confess,
weird. Yeah.
I'm not
yeah.
too familiar.
She's basically
with her.
The "Are you okay?" friend.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Melissa yeah. Joan Hart has a bigger role.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I had a harder time identifying it as Melissa Joan Hart.
That's a good point.
I don't yeah. think I've good, heard. Enough, I don't think I've heard enough Melissa Joan Hart over the years to think I would identify her.
Brian's an expert. Brian no, I binges Sabrina every other day.
Yeah. It's a huge Clarissa fan.
Yes, yes. What do you call that when there's a parade and there's the person who's like the official, like not the mascot, but you know what I'm saying? The
like leading the parade?
Yeah, like leading the parade. She basically, I guess, in the town I live in, Sherman Oaks, she lives here too or something. And there was like in October, they have a festival every year. And she was like that person one year. Wow. You know, like the
I think you call that the Grand Marshal.
Yeah, Grand Marshal. That's what it is. There she was go. The Grand Marshal of that. And I remember thinking, well, I'll be darned. Melissa Joan Hart.
See, she'd be like, I loved you as Dee Dee.
Yes, exactly.
I'm just thinking of like when I've gone to concerts and the artist who's performing will play a particular song, and then you see this like one guy in the audience who lifts up both his arms in the air, doesn't clap, doesn't make any noise, but he does it as if he's playing this for me.
You're right.
And that's what I'm thinking. That's what I'm picturing Brian when he hears Melissa Joan Hart's voice on this.
That's right. That's right. Sherman Oaks is
you hear
very
a voice,
low.
Both arms go up in the air. So we could talk. I'd like to kind of focus a little bit on the animation because I did. I always thought the animation choices with the, you know, the kind of the cyberpunk futuristic look, you know, fit Batman Beyond really well. But then in this, because of the structure that we were talking about earlier, they had to kind of do that and then go to the more traditional animated look for the flashbacks and then go back to the cyberpunk look. And I thought that happened without it being jarring at any point, which I think is critical to make this enjoyable. Because if it was too jarring, then I think it creates too much of an exclamation point on those separations. And I don't think you wanted that. I think you wanted it to kind of flow seamlessly from one to the other, which is, to be honest, as I mentioned, I kind of only picked up on that structure this time around. Like, I never really thought about it before. And I think it's because it was not jarring and it was not really, it never took you out of the story. You just kind of flowed right with it. And I think that is probably a testament to the writing and the animation. I love the character of elderly Bruce Wayne, because he's like a total curmudgeon. He's not taking Terry McGinnis under his wing because he wants to do that. He's doing it because he's got no choice. He can't do this anymore. And if you watched Batman Beyond in the first episode, he's still in the Batman costume and pretty much has a heart attack while he's facing off against some crooks and barely gets out of there alive. And that's when he comes to the realization he can't be Batman anymore. So it's, again, it's not by choice. And it's an interesting thing because I never wanted to see the death of Batman per se, but you always figure Bruce Wayne will die as Batman, that it's, you know, he's not a guy who's going to retire and live a quiet life, which is, you know, we'll talk about that more, I think, when we get to Dark Knight Rises.
One of the things I love that you're pointing out about the performance of the curmudgeon Batman is it was really effective in the fact in this one, there had to be some range, because when he sees the Joker for the first time and he's looking at that face again, hearing that voice, and he's investigating, I mean, really what's going on in front of him, you see a range of emotion that I think just worked really, really well. So them playing that piece, and then you have to have some really real emotional moments around the Tim Drake stuff and what was going on there as well. And I thought that they really did a great job of taking this later version of Batman. And really, I think that's something that works in the Batman comics. It works in other Batman movies. It's, you play Batman a certain way, but then when you have these moments where we see deep humanity from, I think it means more because you kind of see him being very consistent. And they played that up very, very well. And I think it was incredibly effective because those are the moments where you're like really connecting with them. You're like, oh, and your eyes are like glued to him and you're hearing everything that he's saying. So it just, Kevin Conroy's portrayal, man, that was a loss, because just seeing him give some real range to this variation of that character just worked really well in this, because there was a lot going on that Batman had to react to in ways that we're not used to seeing Batman have to really go to a different, like really strong emotional variances. And we got to see some of that with him in this that I think worked really well.
Yeah, Zachy recently had me reread Kingdom Come. And so, you know, you got like grumpy grandpa Batman in that, you know, and it was reminding me of that when I was watching this. And it's funny because, you know, there's a little part of me that's like, oh, I don't think he would like me very much, you know, but like, he's the type of guy who gets the job done, and he is hardened, of course. But then, you know, to Sean's point, then he does have those moments where you do see the vulnerability slip out a little bit. And then like at the end, when he shows up at the hospital to visit Tim, you know, the soft, like that's what makes it so rich, getting all of that. You know, I thought that was really well done in this.
I also give credit to Kevin Conroy for not overstating the elder Batman voice, but giving a distinction between the, you know, relatively youthful and strong Bruce Wayne and the elderly, you know, somewhat weakened Bruce Wayne, even though, you know, at whatever he's supposed to be, 85 years old or whatever it is he's supposed to be, would still probably kick every one of our butts really easily without breaking a sweat. But you hear a difference in the voice. And again, you're going to have those scenes where he's younger, and then you have the scenes where he's older, and you could hear it's the same voice, but it doesn't have that, you know, that over the top old man scratchiness to it. It's just somewhat of a different timbre to it, so that you could tell there's a difference, but not so dramatic that it, you know, that it seems comical. So, you know, I agree with what Sean just said about, you know, what a great loss it is that Kevin Conroy passed from us way too young. I found it interesting when I finally saw him, because I had always heard his voice as Batman. Mm-hmm. And then I was watching an episode of Cheers that he kind of tried to go out with Carla for, you know, right. in the episode. And I didn't even know it was him because he wasn't doing the Batman voice. But then at the end, when I saw the credits and it said Kevin Conroy, I was, wait a minute, I got to rewind that and see that again. You know, it was pretty interesting. Mark Hamill, I mean, I don't know what more superlatives I can give to Mark Hamill's Joker.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, there are probably three or four people that you could say, oh yeah, he was the definitive portrayal of the Joker. Heath Ledger right. was the definitive portrayal. Mark Hamill is the definitive portrayal. Cesar Romero was the definitive portrayal. You know, like it's just, I don't.
Jared Leto. Anybody who says Joker. Was the
no. I don't know anybody who says Jack Nicholson was the definitive portrayal, to be honest. But the funny thing is, and I think we talked about this when we were going over those movies, is Jack Nicholson just kind of laid out the template for what every villain in that series was going to be after him, because they were all just trying to catch up to him. Mm. But, you know, Mark Hamill, I thought it was a bold choice that, I didn't really. I don't know if you'd have any familiarity with this, Brian, but I think Sean and Zachy would. After the Batman the Animated Series ended, they did The Batman, mm-hmm. and they had a very, very different gravelly voiced Joker. And I thought that was a bold choice after, you know, I thought it was a smart choice to not have somebody doing a Mark Hamill imitation. But, you know, there's been definitely some interesting choices there.
Well, I thought it was
anybody else excited. Who's
no, please.
So I agree with you completely. It was I think this performance by Mark Hamill is very hard to follow up. I actually love the interviews you see right now, like current interviews you see with Mark Hamill about this when he brings it up as far as would you portray the Joker again, and how much he looked at it as a Laurel and Hardy, if you will, with him and Kevin Conroy. You know, it's basically he's referenced multiple times. Anytime they asked him to portray the role again, he asked first if Kevin Conroy was doing it. And then it was just kind of didn't matter what the project was, it was a yes. And I mean, that extended to video games. You know, he did the Arkham games and stuff like that, which were fantastic. So I think if you're trying to follow this up, there's a real danger to be Mark Hamill light or even Kevin Conroy light. Mm-hmm. So I think you're right. When they did the Batman, it was a good choice to try and head into a different direction because otherwise you're going to lose something of the power, I think, of the performance.
Yeah, I liked Reno Romano, who did Batman's voice on that show, too. Very just something totally different, you know, and I think that show gets kicked around a lot by people of our vintage. I think people younger than us who grew up with it are fine with it. But I'm always like, you know, it had the misfortune of being first out the chute after the animated series. Mm-hmm. But it's a good show. It's a good interpretation of Batman.
I thought it was, you know, very entertaining. I particularly liked when they did the animated feature on that with Batman versus Dracula. That I thought was pretty cool. I think they probably would have been better off just time-wise if they had had Batman the Brave and the Bold in between those two, because that was such a more of a lighthearted turn that it would have made the, you know, it would have created some contrast so that by the time you got to the Batman, you would have been okay with that. And it wouldn't have been competing with Batman, the animated series. But I would recommend if anybody gets a chance to check that out, I would imagine it's probably available on HBO Max, but I've never actually looked for it. But if it is, I would recommend people check that out as well. Any other voice actors in this that you have any comments or any of the
animation? I want to comment on Hamill again, where when he was playing, I don't remember the character's name, but that board member, you know, from Wayne's Company. It was funny because at first...
Jordan Price.
At first, it took me a second, but then I was like, oh, that's Hamill. He almost has that Yardley Smith sort of thing. You know, where it's like when Right, like she does another voice on The Simpsons. You're like, oh, that's Lisa doing someone else. Like, there's just something in the little, in his timber or whatever it is that he can't disguise. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I thought, oh, he's the Joker. Hello. You know what I mean? Because he's got the slender build. He kind of resembles the Joker without the makeup. It's Mark Hamill doing the voice. I thought I was all clever and had it figured out, you know, on first viewing. And so I enjoyed that fake out. I thought that was kind of brilliant to cast him in there, because then you might think you're ahead of it.
It worked. It worked for me. Full disclosure off of that. I kept, because I, again, that goes back to the comic book reading piece. I'm like, oh, they won't do that with Tim. Like, it can't really be Tim. So I kept thinking it was, until a certain point, I kept thinking, oh, it's probably Jordan. Like, they're setting up. This is the Joker. And then the look, actually, the way the character was drawn, too, gives you kind of this idea that it's the same, similar-ish kind of build and stuff like
all
that.
All lean, yeah.
Yeah, that was a great way to swerve. And I love when they take the time to do stuff like that. It just makes it more entertaining. That was a great choice.
I also thought it was interesting that the character model of the Batman Beyond Joker looked different than the character model of the Batman the Animated Series Joker. And, you know, not only does that distinguish the eras, but it's also, it's not the same physical body, not the same physical form. So I think, you know, that's important, because, you know, when they do a story like this, and it's not, you know, it's not that they haven't done this in other media, but when they do it and the person ends up exactly like the person looked, you know, in their previous body, well, that doesn't seem right to me. To me, that's almost like when they have these movies where you conduct plastic surgery and you make somebody look exactly like the other guy, even though they look nothing alike. You know, what was that, a Face Off with John Travolta and Nick, was it Nicolas Cage? I don't remember too many things from that movie, except that I thought it was awful.
Awfully fun.
Maybe that's just me.
Well, no, because it is funny, because we're to understand it that it's literally just the faces being swapped, but then yes, all of a sudden their physiques somehow has changed as well.
The physiques, even I mean if you went to the best plastic surgeons in the world and asked them to turn one of us into the other,
yeah,
they could give us similar features. But they can't change, well, I mean, I guess you can change to some extent, but you can't totally convert the bone structure of the face and the skull and everything. You know, it's just not done. It's not, you know.
Yeah, we'd wind up being like Edgar really... from Men in Black. We'd be these sort of like, I'm Paul.
Exactly right.
I don't know what you guys are talking about. John Woo told me that Nicolas Cage can pass for John Travolta and vice versa, and I choose to listen to the director of Hard Boiled. That's it.
Okay, well, and that's a choice you make. Yeah, I know we're going afield here, but that's something I always thought was a little silly. But I think it's funny, because when they fixed it, it's in animation. They made him look different as the Joker of, you know, that era. I don't know how many years are supposed to be in between the two eras. But I was curious about that, actually. And then he was... I would look to Zachy to have that information, if anybody. But I guess not. Sure. So...
I like the Harley Quinn appearance in this.
Mm-hmm.
Just a voice to throw out there. I thought that was a neat little thing at the end, of the grandmother, the demon twins wound up to be a reformed Harley Quinn. I thought it was kind of a cool little twist in the whole thing.
I enjoyed that too.
Yeah, I was not expecting that. And I liked that as well. It was interesting. I thought it was interesting that the DD twins, whatever you want to call them, that, like, when they first appeared, they were cowering and not doing anything. And then Batman, like, kind of backed off, or Batman Beyond backed off. And then as soon as he showed, like, the slightest sign of compassion, they just attacked him. And, you know, I thought that was pretty cool, and I thought it was kind of true to kind of the Harley Quinn character. So it was interesting, that Harley Quinn is reformed and not happy with their behavior at the point. And it was a nice little throw in. And I don't know if everybody, if somebody hadn't seen any of this universe at all, I don't know if they even would have realized that was what was going on, which I always like those little Easter eggs where if you know, you know, and you get a kick out of it. And if you don't know, it doesn't bother you. Mm-hmm. So I was going to touch on the score, you know, the very, I guess, cyberpunk again, kind of music. I thought it was pretty effective. I thought it fit the mood of what we were getting in this particular feature. It was not to my tastes. Again, you know, we've talked about like, oh, this is a score that I would, you know, take and put on in the car as I'm driving. It was not that. But I did think it served its purposes for the mood of this particular piece. And I think it helped to create a feel as you went through different things. So I would give it a successful rating as far as that goes.
Yeah, I was looking at the date at 2000, I wondered at the very beginning if it was going to have sort of a Matrix-y sort of influence. Like I was noticing sort of the dissonant horns kind of thing in the first fight, that dun, 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 kind of thing. And so I was like, oh, are they just because Matrix is so recent and hot in that moment? But it actually didn't do that as much as I thought it would. Like it was sort of like the almost like nu metal, sort of like beats with metal guitar kind of thing. I agree, not something maybe I would put on, but it fit the tone, I thought.
I think one of the things they did with the score that worked really well is for if you were coming at this from being a fan of the animated series, which I watched, I didn't see every episode of Batman Beyond. Similar to what Brian was saying about, you know, just the timing for my life for me, that's why it was destination television, I think, for me. Like when it was on and I was there, I wanted to watch it. So I enjoyed the show a great deal. I still haven't to this day seen every episode. And I want to actually, because I really enjoy it. But I think what happens with these animated series is you want to make these releases when you get into the movie aspect of it, feel like the production values have stepped up a bit. Mm-hmm. It feels like something special. And this succeeded in doing that. If you're a fan of the animated series, you feel like, oh, wow, this is like a souped up, like, special moment. And I think that they did a great job of doing that with the score as well. It's not just the animation and the, you know, the length of the depth of the story. It was also done with the score. And I think that was something that we saw in Mask of the Phantasm as well, where that felt like a production leap. I felt like this felt like a production leap, which is a victory in and of itself.
I don't disagree with you, but I also thought that the animation was consistent with what we got before. Mm-hmm. I don't think it didn't necessarily cry out. I mean, and it was a made for home viewing release. It was not a theatrical release, but it didn't have that feel that it cried out for. Oh, you know, you need to watch this on the big screen because it's so much more bombastic than what we've had in the past. It felt consistent with the stories. I think the actual storyline was what made it more movie-like to me, as opposed to the presentation of it. I think the presentation felt consistent with what I had gotten in the past, but the writing, the acting, and everything was just so well done that it created a theatrical feel for it, even though it was made for home viewing.
Paul, I have very similar feelings. That was, yeah, I thought it felt, and this isn't a ding against it. I mean, this is just without any other context that this may feel elevated from the series itself, but just with my limited experience with it, comparing it to Mask of Phantasm, I was like, oh, it feels a little less cinematic than that one. But the writing was very strong, you know, and the action was still a lot of fun. So it was just a different arena for me, in terms of it being a special standalone, you know, own on a DVD release, mm-hmm, next to Mask of Phantasm or something. A little bit more like, you know what I'm saying? Like it felt like an elevated weekday afternoon thing with great writing to me versus something that would have been made and animated and put into theaters.
Mm-hmm. That's totally matching what I meant by it's a step up. It's a step up from the show itself. I like that aspect of it.
Totally.
Now, if I remember correctly, I think this followed up Sub-Zero, which was in between this and Mask of the Phantasm. And that, to me, looking back on it, felt kind of like it was just put together and put out there. It didn't, it wasn't bad, but it just felt like a longer episode of the animated series. This felt like it, again, I thought that the storyline and what they did in it just made it more significant. Even though, again, you know, as we're saying, that it didn't necessarily have the bombastic cinematic feel to it, it still felt very significant as I was watching it. And I think that was what made it different than a lot of other animated features that have come since. I question and criticize a lot of DC's choices for their animated features, because I think they've, in some cases, sacrificed creativity to just highlight Batman and Superman, Superman, Batman, 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 Superman. You know, they don't really feel like they're expanding their world all that often. Whereas this felt like it took the world they had and it expanded it. And that's, I think, what made this special.
Totally agree. And I got to say, at the middle, I mean, I for a split second was like, is Batman going to die? Like, am I? Yeah. I mean, and in seeing him die at the hand of seemingly the Joker, I was mad. Like, I didn't, that's not how I wanted him to go out. So it had me.
That is always key. If they can make you actually believe they're going to kill off the characters, if they can make the story have some weight to it because you start being afraid of what's going to happen, then I think they win. And you want them to win. You're not battling against that. So to me, that's also key. You know, and a lot of times, there are many times where we're sitting and watching something and, you know, whoever I'm watching with, whether it's my wife, one of the kids, whatever, and they'll say, oh, are they going to kill off so-and-so? And I just kind of scoff and say, nah, they're not going to kill off this person. It most recently happened watching the Stranger Things finale. I was like, there's no way they're killing off 11. It's just not happening. And then they made you think they killed her off. Spoilers, by the way. They made you think that they killed her off. And I kept saying, nope, it's not, you know, they're going to show us that they didn't. On rare occasions, I've been wrong and they have killed off some characters, but more often than not, my skepticism is borne out.
Right.
So
I liked the piece. We kind of didn't really talk about this totally. I liked the Tim reveal and the way that they did it without hurting the character, because it looked like, I loved that they made it look like Tim was the Joker. I mean, Tim had was still corrupted. And I mean, they had me believing that, oh man, they're going all in on this. I liked that they didn't. I liked that it turned out to be the chip thing. And I liked how that all worked. And I applaud the choice, but I actually liked how bold it looked. I mean, cause there was I will admit, there's a period of time where I'm like, oh, they're really doing this. What they did to him when he was young, that made him into the Joker. I mean, it's like, ooh. I really liked the drama in this. Mm-hmm. That there were periods of time, you mentioned the disbelief, you know, as far as are they going to kill Bruce here? I thought, I'm like, are they going this place with Tim? And there was multiple touch points in this. And that's where I think the writing really succeeds, is they took us on a really cool journey in this, mm-hmm. where there were multiple periods of times where they were swerving, and it made you think. It made you captivated. You didn't have downtime in this one, which, you know, some of these movies, there's sometimes when they go to a movie, when it's something that was a television series, it feels like it's stretched out and there's filler in there somewhere because you never quite get the pace. This had no pacing issues at all. It cooked all the way through. There was just a lot going on, and any story beats where it slowed down, you needed in order to be captivated with what was going on and understanding it.
Totally.
I'm going to show my age on this a little bit, but I have memories of watching as a kid, you know, very young kid, TV series where they did movie length version. And I think actually they may have been theatrical releases on these. I'm not 100% sure. And I'm specifically thinking of, they came out with A Man Called Flintstone, which I think was a theatrical release. And then there was Munster Go Home, which I think was also a theatrical release. And they really did feel, and it's been years since I've seen either one of them, but they really did feel like just a stretched out version to make you want to see it in the movies, but just not, you know, we would lose the heart of what the original series had. You know, I'm thinking about A Man Called Flintstone. They had some like musical interludes in there that just, you know, as a little kid took me out of it, and just things like that. You know, there were a couple of almost psychedelic things in there. this didn't have that. And that's one of the measuring sticks that I use when you take an animated series and now you give a full length version of it. I would think, Zachy and Brian, you could probably relate to, I remember when they came out with the first Simpsons movie, I went to the movies to see that with my kids, and we liked it, and there were moments in it that we laughed a lot. So it was still an enjoyable experience, but it just felt like three episodes of the show put together, to be honest with you. There was nothing about it that made it feel so special that it had to be on the big screen. I don't know if you guys had a similar feel or not, but there's some of that. And this, I mean, this wasn't even on the big screen, but this had the feel of something that was special compared to what you got in the regular series. It felt like there was something that made it worthwhile to make this a feature-length movie.
Actually, I'm very curious to hear what Zachy thinks about the Simpsons movie in that respect.
Honestly, I don't remember having watched it since the theater, so it's distant enough in my memory that I don't have a good point of comparison, you know?
I think it was a little more successful for me. I like that it felt very big, and, you know, all of Springfield is in this disaster film kind of thing. And the animation itself was very different.
The animation was smoother. I remember that.
Yeah. Just, you know, more.
But the TV show has adopted a lot of that, right? Like since the movie came out.
Since going, yeah, like computer animated, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I do. It's almost one of those things where I can't look at it objectively just because it's like literally woven into the fabric of who I am, the Simpsons TV show. So it does inherently feel weird to be watching a 90-minute story in the theater of The Simpsons, something I'm having a hard time putting into words. It does feel a little weird, but I do remember it feeling epic and on a bigger scale. And I think Hans Zimmer did the score, and I remember that feeling, it making it feel a little more cinematic. So I feel like it achieved some feeling. Not like just for me, not like just stitched together episodes, but like a bigger, grander story with the Simpsons characters.
I remember being in the theater, and I'm kind of in Zachy's place where it's been so distant because I saw it in the theater,
right?
And I remember loving it in the theater. But that being said, to your point, the production values on the show have changed since then. So right. I wonder now, because I remember being in the theater and I remember there being multiple sequences where, because they were using computer animation, and it felt like this big step up. I don't remember that one being one that there was a pacing issue with in the theater. Like, but I'm going back to trying to remember what my viewing was like back in the day. Interesting. That's one that actually now I'm curious to watch again. Just because it came up here.
Maybe we'll cover that one at some point. But I seem to remember feeling like I enjoyed it, you know, just like I enjoyed watching The Simpsons every Sunday at that time. But I don't remember thinking this feels special. I think that's what it comes down to. I didn't have that feeling when I walked away from it. I thought it was good, but I always thought The Simpsons were good. So it's, you know, it's like it just felt like more of the same is what it felt like to me.
And am I wrong? Is that 19 years ago now? Speaking for Zachy and Sean, if they haven't seen it since the theater, I mean, that's a long time ago.
Yeah, that's right. 19 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. So, you know, we're going pretty far afield here, and we could get back to the Return of the Joker. And I'm ready to give it a rating unless you guys have anything more to add.
Well, real quick, I did want to speak about the different versions. I thought that was interesting. Zachy brought that up earlier. I guess it was sort of a post-Columbine decision where they were thinking a little bit more about violence in cartoons. And so I was looking at the differences and I thought they were kind of interesting. I mean, it was, you know, when Joker has his big Joker has his big satellite laser at the end, one of the changes was it originally in the version that I think we all probably watched recently, it destroys a movie theater with its lights on. So, you know, there's probably people inside watching movies, but in the alternate version, it's like some sort of, you know, darkened, abandoned looking building or something. And I just thought there were some interesting changes, the choices that they made.
Yeah. I mean, it softened it up, but I think I would have elected, rather than soften it up, I would have just had the warnings on it so that you knew, you know, this might not be appropriate for your six-year-old. You know, I think that would have been good enough for me.
At the time, though, if at the history of this one, at the timing, there were some things going on real world that affected this film as well. So right. There were some real shootings and actual violence that were going on that kind of put pressure, I think, on the studio to do this.
Right.
So I think that was more driven. I agree with you, Paul, on where you're going with this. And I think now you'd probably get that. But I think they had to make that choice. Oh, I don't know if you get it now. Here's all bets are off.
Well, they had the Warner's Kids label, right, at the beginning.
Yes.
Maybe that specifically.
Yeah.
Makes them have to make harder decisions.
Yeah. And I think you have to react to what was going on at the time in the media, you know, as far as, you know, there was real world stuff going on that, like, I don't know about releasing this way.
Yeah.
I'm going to just read a couple of paragraphs from the Wikipedia page about the release, where it says Return of the Joker was originally set for release on Halloween 2000, but following the backlash against violence in children's media that resulted from the Columbine High School massacre in 1999 and general apprehension by higher-ups at WB over the film's content, the creative team was forced to make edits that delayed its release to December 12, 2000. The most dramatic change was the method of the Joker's death. In the PG-13 theatrical, and it has that in quotes, version of the film, he is impaled by a flag shot out of a handgun by Tim Drake. In the unrated television version of the film, he's electrocuted after being tangled in water tubing. Nearly 2 years after the film's initial release and following online petitions, Warner Home Video released an uncut and unaltered version of Return of the Joker with more violence and some altered language, as well as the Joker's original death scene. While the 2000 release was not rated, the PG-13 theatrical version was the first animated Batman film to receive a PG-13 rating from the Motion Picture Association, as well as the only PG-13 rated film to be released under Warner Brothers' now defunct Family Entertainment label. So whoever mentioned Columbine, I you know, obviously we're on the money with that. I tend to think, and I don't know, I think a lot of this stuff is driven by money, but I tend to think in that situation, what I probably would have been more inclined to do was just to delay the release until things had settled down a little bit and you didn't have the same fears of a backlash. Mm. But that may not work financially for these studios with their plans as far as release dates and, you know, when what income they expect from certain projects. So I think there's a lot more business and marketing decisions that come into play with these things that don't always deal with being the most creative or putting the best product out there so much as putting the most financially beneficial product or the one least likely to get a backlash. So, you know, for better or for worse, that's the way things are. But I'm glad they eventually got to release the unedited, the original unaltered version, because I do think without having a specific memory of the original, I'm still inclined to say that this is the superior version. Mm. So I'm going to say I really am on the fence. I feel like sometimes I'm too quick to give things a Jaws rating. So I'm sitting there saying, is this Jaws or is this Jaws 2? I don't want to call everything a masterpiece, you know, but I also don't want to critically shoot things down. I don't know that this is a masterpiece. I think it's really, really solid. I like it very, very much. I think it accomplishes everything it's trying to accomplish. And there's not a heck of a lot in it that I would even think about changing. And even if I did, I don't know after consideration if I would change. All that said, I still think I'm going to give it a very high Jaws 2. I think I have to be a little stingy on my Jaws ratings sometimes. I don't want to be too quick to throw those out all the time. But really tempting to make it a Jaws.
So I struggled with my rating too. And I actually watched this twice because I hadn't seen it. So I'm like, I really do need to watch it again. So I'm not just going off of the new car smell that you kind of get with films sometimes when you just enjoyed it. But well, then what I also did is I rewatched Mask of the Phantasm because I needed a barometer because I do think that's a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. And that's a short list one. I agree, actually, Paul, totally with the high Jaws 2. I think anybody listening to this, if you haven't seen this, you need to see this. This is cool. This is a very, very cool movie. I'm struggling with not giving it Jaws. The reason why I'm making it a high Jaws 2 is because when I watch Mask of the Phantasm and I see a masterpiece, I'm like, ooh, it's so close. And I do feel that. I feel it's very, very close to the quality of Mask of the Phantasm, but I don't want to put it at Mask of the Phantasm. So I'm giving it a Mask of the Phantasm 2.
I'll jump in because I think I agree. With that in mind, even with Mask of the Phantasm. You know, I thought this movie was, my first viewing, I thought it was very solid. I thought it was very strong, and there's a lot of really strong moments in it. And then every now and then I would notice, like, you know, McGinnis's girlfriend was in the hospital, and then it was kind of like we didn't think about her again. And I was thinking, like, man, if we have, like, a scene of him at her bed, you know, and, like, that even being part of the motivation, like, just those little... those moments would have made it even a little richer in between all of the solid moments for me. So at the end of the day, I thought it was really, really good. And so I'm going to go with, like, Jaws 2.
Well, I'm going to say Jaws just to flip the bird to all you nattering nabobs of negativity. I would put it very comparably with Mask of the Phantasm. I mean, I'm not even going to bother trying to say which one I like better. I think both of these are examples of how you can use the medium of animation to tell mature, compelling stories about Batman. And, you know, they really highlight something I say all the time, that Batman is just one of those characters who is so elastic. You can do all kinds of stories with. I love Batman Beyond. As I said at the start of this discussion, that entire series is kind of this hidden gem that a lot of people have sort of glanced past, you know, and I think this movie is a great exemplar of everything that show did so well.
I can't argue with that at all. I think it's excellent. It's just a matter of where it lands on the scale.
Yeah.
So that's it for this. Next time out would be Batman Begins. And I'm really looking forward to getting into the Nolanverse movies with you guys. But based on our conversation today, I think I might want to take a little swerve and pause Batman for a little while, and maybe next time out that we get you guys together, do the Simpsons movie. And ooh, then come back to Batman after that.
I am into it. Yeah.
I'm down. Yeah.
Wait, I have a question too. Have you ever rated anything Jaws 19?
Yes, there was definitely, I don't know what it was, but I definitely rated one Jaws 19, and it may have been the Christmas that almost wasn't, something along those lines. I know it came before we had a Jaws 19 rating, but we did The Last Shark, which is an Italian Jaws ripoff movie that I definitely rated a Jaws 4, but I think I may have rated it Jaws 19 if that had been in existence at the time. There was, I'm sure I rated at least one Jaws 19.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a good question. Thank you guys for coming on. And I'm going to just make mention again of the Movie Film Podcast, which is, I don't want to submarine my own show here, but that's my favorite movie podcast.
Thank you.
So I look forward to getting those and listening to them and listening to the the commentaries when you guys do them. And what I always say about it is you guys have the only commentaries that I'm aware of that I enjoy listening to, even if I don't know the movie that you're talking about.
Wow.
Which is huge. Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Thank you guys for making the time to come on. I appreciate it. I think you elevate the level of our show with your presence.
Love being
here. I appreciate it. So I'll try and get together with you guys in the not too distant future to do the Simpsons movie, and then we'll come back to Batman after that.
That sounds great.
Thank you guys for coming on. Thank you everybody for listening, and we'll catch you in 2 weeks. Bye bye.
Oh God. I killed him. I didn't mean to. I tried so hard to forget, but I still hear the shot. Still see his dead smile. Every night the dreams get stronger. He's there when I sleep, whispering, laughing, telling me I'm just as bad as he is. We're both the same.
I'm calling an ambulance.
No, I'm all right. Forgive me, Terry. Old nasty memories twisting inside me like bad oysters. Nothing, really. I'm perfectly fine now.
How do you know my name?
There's nothing about you I don't know, bat fake.
Terry!
Have a time out, kid. Can't let you spoil the party too soon. And Bruce, I'm sure you've got your monkey boy wired somehow. That's just peachy, because I want you to see every minute of this. It's a killer.
My God.
Oh, I never get tired of that.
Drake? You're the Joker?
That flabby oaf doesn't even realize I'm using him as a timeshare. Beneath this puckish exterior lies the mind of a genius, years ahead of my time. In the weeks young Robin was under my tutelage, I used him as the subject of my greatest experiment. Utilizing cutting-edge genetics technology, which I had pinched here and there, I encoded my DNA on a microchip and set it into Bird Boy's bird brain. Here. Everything that was me has been asleep and all comfy and cozy inside Tim Drake's subconscious. At first, I had to limit the time I spent in Drake's body. He's not aware of what I do, chalking up any lingering memories to bad dreams. If his family misses him, I simply call wifey and tell her,
I'm working late, honey.
The changes come at will now, and soon I'll be strong enough to live in this body permanently. Mr. J's on the rebound, baby! My comeback party's gonna set the whole town on fire!